2021-3366, Mr. Ashford.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Timothy Ashford, and I'm a pro se appellant in this particular case. And as I walked in, I noticed there were some pictures of judges on the wall, some of whom were African American. And let me get right to the point. If the Douglas County panel, who's the appellee in this case, had to choose your judges, there wouldn't be an African American on this panel. Does this court want African American attorneys on the panel to accept murder cases in Douglas County? After you review the case law, the answer is yes. And the case law I refer to is Mitchell v. Fishbein, which is the only case which applies in this particular case. Mitchell is a case out of New York, and it has to do with a black attorney who was denied a seat on the panel to accept murder cases. And by the way, this is not in the record, but when I filed this particular litigation, a number of African-American attorneys, including me, started to receive misdemeanor appointments from this court. So the Mitchell case is exactly on point on my case, and appellee can't say it isn't. And the only response they had in their had their response was, it's based on incorrect law. That's not telling me anything. But let me tell you, the Mitchell v. Fishbein, it was an African-American attorney. He was banned from a list like me, and he made a complaint. I wrote an article, is the Douglas County Court racist? And the reason I wrote that article is because they weren't giving us the court appointments they should have been giving us.
Can I ask a question,
just
a procedural question on your complaint? As I read your complaint, that you have alleged that you filed an application with the Douglas County Court Administrator, and you requested that you be listed on the panel for murder cases in particular, and then you allege that you didn't get a response, but and that's correct, right?
Correct.
Now, what do we not need to, if we don't know the response, has it been alleged here that you've actually been denied, a spot on that panel?
Right now, I'm not on the panel. Because here's how it works. They have you selected for two particular cases, misdemeanor and felony. Then they have you in another class, felony and murder. I haven't been changed to that felony murder class, so the injury to me is still ongoing. Okay? This is based on a violation of my constitutional rights, and the court incorrectly dismissed this case with prejudice based upon their case law. They said I failed to state a claim, which I properly did, and I believe is the First Amendment complaint, paragraph 48. Now, I filed a motion for us to argue. The appellee basically stated no argument is necessary. You asked to be here, and this is probably the first and only time you're going to hear this. I really didn't want to be here. You're either going to give me my constitutional rights or you're not. Now, before we spend the next 30 minutes asking various questions about the case law, let me get right to the point. None of the appellee's cases apply to my case. And let me summarize them for you. They argue judicial immunity of the lawyers filing lawsuit is all these cases had an argument for judicial immunity. That's what they see it. And it applies in my case. They weren't based on race or constitutional violations. She had the Davis v. Tarrant case. In that case, a white man filed a lawsuit based upon the fact that he wasn't part of the good old boys network.
He did claim constitutional violations, correct?
Yeah, but,
for sure. Go ahead.
But his argument was, and that's why they dismissed it, I'm not part of the good old boys network. The other one she uses is the Morales case, which is a Supreme Court case, and that was based upon the excessive force by the judge. A white man somewhere was out doing something with the judge, and they got into a dispute, and the judge sent the police to get him, and the police came back and brought him, and he filed it. The Ninth Circuit agreed with that attorney, and the Supreme Court pulled it up and said, we are not going to have this nonsense. That wasn't based on race.
Well, how it seems to me we've got this interesting sort of situation where you've got a panel decide making these decisions, right? The panel, I'll call it the panel selection committee. It's this combination of judges and lawyers. How is this the same or different than simply appointing an individual a lawyer for an individual case, which I think the case law is pretty clear. That's a judicial function. The judge says, you, attorney X, are appointed to represent defendant Y. How is this panel selection committee like that or not like that?
I'm not familiar with their whole process, but I could kind of analyze it. Basically, they put you on the list, the lower list for the blacks, the misdemeanors and felonies, the higher list for the whites, white male attorneys and some white females, which is murder and felonies. So that's the only way I can analyze it. And when it comes up, they'll appoint you based upon what they put you in, your lower class or your upper class. I'm still not on the panel to accept murder cases. In Nebraska, to be able to handle a murder case, you have to have a law license. That's it. You don't have to have any. We're not a specialty state where you need to have some kind of specialty to be able to handle a particular case. And basically, they've grandfathered in the evidence. If I got past the 12B6 motion, they've grandfathered in a lot of white males by giving them murder appointments with no experience.
Does the Nebraska Supreme Courts and the Nebraska courts in death penalty cases follow the ABA standards for defense counsel? Have you heard of the American Bar Association standards? The American Bar Association standards for, I think it's effective death counsel. Do you know if Nebraska follows those? Some states do, some states don't. Don't worry about it. It's not important.
I couldn't answer that. I didn't brief that. But you do understand I did file a motion to take judicial notice. And I don't know if you've had the opportunity to review that.
That motion's been taken with the case.
And what happened in that case, the first case right off the bat, says James T. Gleason in the Omaha World Herald was accused of not saying anything racist when his court reporter made a racist statement. Also in there is my Supreme Court case in State v. Rice, who's a former Black Panther Party member for self-defense, who I represented for 17 years. I was assigned and court-appointed by Judge Gleason, and as soon as I filed this lawsuit, he refused my payment. I had to go up on appeal to get my money. That's in the notice motion to take judicial notice. I'm showing you the reason I did that was to show you what kind of panel we're dealing with. And you...
Now, let me ask you. Go ahead.
You can go ahead and reverse this 12B6 and let me proceed with my lawsuit based on the Fishbein case.
Okay. Now, good. We're back to law. On Birch versus Mazander, do you know it's our Eighth Circuit case?
Yes.
It has some language, which I'm certain you're aware of, about how judicial immunity would apply in a case like this, and it is an Eighth Circuit case.
I'm familiar with that.
I figured you were. Now, address why it applies or doesn't.
It does not apply because that was attached to a case or controversy. Mine is not attached to a case or controversy, and that's the reason that I say Birch does not apply. If a judge issues a ruling on a particular motion for summary judgment or a criminal matter, you can't sue him. Otherwise, the courts would be clogged with people who are basically suing the judges for a wrong decision. Yeah. Now, in my case, it's not a case or controversy. This panel does not have to say, Mr. Ashford, you filed a motion for summary judgment and we don't like it. It's different. These are apples and oranges. This is a case of first impression to me in this jurisdiction. And based upon that, I'd say, Your Honor, when you have a constitutional violation, you basically allow this to go forward as the Mitchell v. Fishbein case. And I didn't get to the Virginia case, which they didn't address in their particular brief.
Can I ask another kind of practical question? How did you get on? Well, let me ask it this way: what type of cases are you being assigned right now?
I'm getting the disturbing the peace, lower. I've been practicing for 25 years. I'm getting the lower level first years cases.
Misdemeanors and non-important felony. And how does that work? Like, procedurally, how did you get to that point where you, what was the process? Did you apply and they just slotted you in, and did you get notice? Mr. Ashford, can get misdemeanors, non-murder felonies, but not murders.
You want to know how I got to that point? I'm black. I was not put up. No, really, truly. They don't have any blacks, and they've never appointed a black.
So you were never told any. It just happened.
They don't talk to me. They don't respond to me. I'll send them a letter. They won't send it back. It's the cold shoulder. That's what they do. But the Virginia v. Consumers, and I want, they never addressed this in this brief, and that's where, just like our case, in my brief, the Virginia case, the court held because the Virginia statute gave the court independent authority. In our case, the court gave them independent authority to go ahead, and that's a Supreme Court case, to go ahead and start assigning these particular people for appointments. The court and its members were proper defendants in a suit for declaratory injunctive relief. Now, out of all the people you have up here, I'm the only one who's not asking for money. I'm doing this because it's the right thing. And I'm telling you that you have the power to reverse that 12B6 motion because they based it on law, de novo. And the judge admits in the opinion, hey, this was split. So he flipped a coin. His coin was flipped, and he went against me. You can flip that coin back.
Good. You are into your rebuttal. You can use it now or save it.
I'm going to save it.
Good. Done. Okay, Ms. Caldwell.
Hi, good morning. May it please the court. Stephanie Caldwell from Nebraska, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees in this case, which include the judge members of the panel selection committee, the PSC, that we've referred to in our brief.
Now, let me ask you a question off the bat. If I read the statute right, there's a public defender who's on this panel, right?
That's correct.
But no public defender's been sued, and apparently one's not acting. Tell me.
One of the appellees in this case, I was further in my introduction, is appellee Thomas Riley. So he has been sued, and he is an appellee in this case, and he's the Douglas County public defender. So the remaining appellees or parties in this case are five judges out of Douglas County and the active public defender, Thomas Riley.
Okay, so he is a part of this suit.
Yes, he is.
Proceed. I'm sorry.
No, glad to clarify. So this case does involve two issues, and that is it's an immunity case. I mean, did the district court properly dismiss the case against the judges based on judicial immunity? And then did the district court properly dismiss the case against the non-judge, the public defender, Thomas Riley, in this case? It was filed as a 12B6 motion, and myself, on behalf of the appellees, argued immunity. I think Mr. Ashford provided a good background of what the nexus of his complaint was, but I'd like to provide a little bit of background as to this process and explain it. But the Nebraska legislature did task the process for the appointment of counsel directly to the judges. The Nebraska Supreme Court then adopted a local rule requiring each district to come up with a transparent process. And Douglas County, in this case, did exactly that. They created the D.C. panel, the Douglas County panel, and they had a panel selection committee that was memorialized in their local rule.
Does it or does not it include private attorneys in addition to the judges and the public defender?
That's correct. The panel is composed of two district court judges, two county court judges, a public defender, and two private practice attorneys with significant experience in criminal cases.
Well, why aren't they defendants, those two lawyers?
They were not properly served in this case. Okay. They were named, but there was a lot of procedural dismissals at the beginning of this case. They were never properly served by the appellants in this case,
proceed.
So they are not. So this panel was created, and it was modeled and almost taken verbatim from the federal panel under the Criminal Justice Act that each district in this circuit uses and applies to this day.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but I do have a question sort of similar to what I asked Mr. Ashford. How does somebody get notice, or how is the communication between the applicant and the committee? Is it unusual to just not get a response? Is that how you're denied placement on this committee?
I don't believe there's anything. I have the rule right in front of me, Judge, and it talks about that the attorney shall be their qualifications. There's nothing that I can find in the rule that said they had to actually receive a letter. It did say they will be assigned to a specific category of a case, but then if that attorney disputes that category, so there must be some type of method that they're made aware of this, and I honestly don't know. It's not in the record or in the rule that they're made aware of this, because then they're given an avenue to dispute this, and I think that's a big thing that distinguishes our case from the Mitchell case that Mr. Ashford relies so heavily upon, and that the Second Circuit and Mitchell found there was no type of avenue for the appellant or the persons denied to have a review in that case. And Mitchell involved an actual denial. The appellant in Mitchell got an actual denial letter, and that's not actually been alleged in this case.
Is the appeal back to this panel? Who is the appeal to? You referred to an appeal. Is it
right,
back to the panel?
Within the rule itself, it says if an attorney is dissatisfied with the category they've received or non-placement, they can put in written a written explanation, submit it to the panel. The panel then will sit and
it's
hear.
It's back to the same panel. Go
goes
ahead.
Back to the same sure. panel. But it's an avenue of relief and a type of a second step, which Mitchell really defined, saying this was the end-all step. You know, once you're denied, you're denied. So I think that's just another factor, and I plan to go into more on how this case is just distinguished from Mitchell. And Mr. Ashford is correct. We heavily rely upon the Morales versus Waco case. That's the Supreme Court case for setting the standard for judicial immunity. Does it constitute a judicial act, which is the main issue in this case, and was it taken within jurisdiction?
Yeah, and why isn't this a little sufficiently enough different from appointing someone, an attorney, in an individual case, particularly when you have the array of panels that Judge Benton has described, panel members, as described, they're not all judges, they're lawyers. Why isn't this one step removed from that judicial function of appointment in a particular case?
And that's a good question, and that's the Davis case that we relied upon, the Fifth Circuit case, I think did a really good explanation of this as we acknowledge that this panel, like in Davis and the Fifth Circuit, doesn't involve actual appointments to an actual specific and concrete case. But the Mitchell case in the Second Circuit doesn't say that it has to be a specific concrete case. Davis explained that you need to look at this process as a whole, look at it holistically, and that you can't separate the two acts into an administrative act and then to a judicial act. The panel in this case was doing the same type of using or exercising the same type of discretion a judge would do in appointing an attorney to a specific case. They look at the criteria of the attorney. They look at their background and their experience. Have they completed significant hours in continuing legal education? And the ultimate goal and purpose of this panel was to provide competent counsel to indigent attorneys, to provide kind of a shortcut for Douglas County, the largest county in Nebraska, to then not have to have that judge in that specific case do that inquiry. The panel has done that inquiry for the judge, and they may then choose from that selection.
But if you carry that extension to the judicial function in this process of selection by the panel, it does insulate that panel, the non-judges, from potentially discriminatory actions.
And I think that's why we've argued in the second part of our brief that they're doing a function that is similar to that of a judge, which would provide them the same immunity, quasi-judicial immunity, and that they've been tasked this process through the courts. They've been given the statutory responsibility through the courts to act in the same manner as a judge does. And it's well established for quasi-judicial purposes for non-judges in this case. You look at the function, not the actor. So that might be why part of our second part of our brief specifically addressing quasi-judicial immunity is a little shorter, in that it's the same test. You're looking at, is it judicial in nature? Is it one that is normally performed by a judge? And as Judge Benton pointed out, yes, the Birch case is very controlling in this case. And Birch was cited by the Fifth Circuit Davis case that we've asked this court to adopt and follow, contrary to Mitchell, and that they cite and rely on this circuit, saying that the appointment of counsel is a function normally performed by a judge and is judicial in nature.
Is injunctive relief sought in the
in this case?
Part of the addendum is cut off that has that, but the majority of it, the complaint asks for general and punitive damages, and that it, the last paragraph asks for or any other relief the court may deem appropriate. So I don't know if that would.
So it doesn't specify.
It doesn't specify a specific remedy. It just asks. It actually does ask for monetary damages against these judges.
Well, but I couldn't find it either. I just wanted to make sure that we're not talking about a specific request for injunctive relief to address this alleged inequitable situation.
Right. You know, and even if it were.
So are you telling me it does not?
I mean, it just asks for injunctive and equitable relief as the court may deem appropriate. So I don't think Mr. Ashford spelled it out. That's what he's asked for and stated in his complaint. The majority of the paragraphs preceding it ask for monetary, general,
Have you addressed the injunctive, the reference to injunctive relief in this case and in your motion to dismiss?
Yeah,
the district court didn't mention it.
No, and I don't think it was mentioned. I don't know if it was brought up. They did dismiss the case as a whole. And I'm trying to recall, Your Honor, I believe it's the Roth versus King case, the United States Supreme Court case, that says the immunity would still apply, the judicial immunity would still attach, even if it were asking for injunctive relief. And I believe that's Roth versus King, which is cited in our case. So even if it were to be determined that Mr. Ashford's complaint did amount to asking for injunctive relief, the immunity would not be stripped of the judges and the public defender in this case.
The Birch case acts like it's still an open issue, but the Birch is a 1982 case. What date was the Roth case?
I can look here somewhere. 2006.
Thank
and that's
you.
The Roth case.
I'm just wondering,
what would be the reasoning behind judicial immunity protected all of these defendants, let's just assume it did, what would be the policy argument or what would be the reason that injunctive relief to address a discriminatory situation, why would that not be appropriate and respectful of the relationship between the federal and state courts?
And I understand that, but I think the precedent is still clear that the immunity is still afforded to a judge. It's not just an immunity from damages. It's immunity from a suit as a whole. So I don't think Mr. Ashford has even alleged facts significant or proper to be entitled to the injunctive relief. I don't think he's requested that.
So then what's the recourse? What's the recourse for an attorney who's been discriminated against by a state court in this kind of situation, if the judge is immune and can't be sued for injunctive relief, what's the remedy?
Well, and I don't know.
There's just no remedy? It's just too
bad?
Well,
if we're going to go off of the precedent of the United States Supreme Court, I mean, Forrester versus White and Morales versus Waco is, and I understand the allegations he's raised, and I understand your concerns, too, are significant, these discrimination cases. You know, allegations. But even if it's alleged that a judge acted in bad faith or was malicious, judicial immunity still applies. So, you know, if a person were to, you know, I can think of a situation where a defendant, you know, a lot of times would allege a judge might have been discriminatory in nature. There is no avenue. If that judge is acting in a judicial capacity and the acts he's doing are judicial in nature.
Well, a criminal defendant has recourse through the criminal appellate system,
right?
And then later through habeas to a federal court. But an attorney in this situation, I'm just curious what is the remedy?
And I think based on the precedent of this circuit and the other circuits is, if it is a judicial act, it's. You know, if it's
counsel, you have a judicial discipline commission, and any attorney can file. In fact, any attorney must file if they have proof of a discriminatory act. They must file a complaint with the judicial commission if someone's discriminatory.
Thank you for answering my question, Judge. But the
buried question there is: I assume Nebraska has a judicial discrimination.
That's absolutely correct, and that's
judicial discipline commission.
And I would imagine that that's an avenue they could take. They could file a complaint with them. But to actually seek monetary...
Let me ask you another question. Does Nebraska have extraordinary writs? In Missouri, the Supreme Court has general superintending authority of lower courts and gives many mandamus prohibition and different other kinds of writs. Are writs available in Nebraska court or not?
I believe there are some type of emergency writs. I don't know them off the top of my hand. I know once I had to think about that once when we were dealing with the district court, but I believe that is another avenue that they could pursue. But I think
is this judicial panel in the judicial branch of government?
It was created by the judicial branch.
Yeah, but is it in the judicial branch of Nebraska government? It's just a fact question.
I think it is, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I think they're acting as judicial officers. The non-judges and the public defender, the reason they wanted the public defender on this, and the public defender is also on the federal Criminal Justice Act plan panel, is the expertise that a public defender would provide. Under these rules, you know, the cases would first go to the public defender, but if there's a situation where it can't, then it would go on to this appointment list. And I think that's why it's very beneficial to have the public defender, if they're unable to handle the case due to a conflict, to have their input and discretion. I mean, ultimately, they are reviewing these.
Do the public defenders in Nebraska have to be Nebraska attorneys?
I believe so.
Okay, subject to discipline of the Nebraska Bar.
I would assume
for
all
Discrimination
practicing
Act.
Attorneys. Yes, yeah, I would good. Assume all practicing attorneys. So I see I'm short on time, but I really do think the Birch case in this case is very controlling. The appointments in this case are judicial in nature. The Davis case does a really good job from the Fifth Circuit of setting forth why this circuit should not rely upon the Mitchell case, and I've tried to outline that in my brief, but it really distinguishes the Mitchell case from our case, and I think that this circuit should adopt it and uphold the ruling of the district court that the judges are absolutely immune from this case, and the non-judge in this case, the public defender, is also entitled to quasi-judicial immunity. Thank you.
Mr. Ashford?
Yes, I'd like to clear up some things she said. You asked about the private attorneys, and what occurs is they are on a rotating basis, the private attorneys. So when this suit was filed, I didn't get service on them because they're off the panel. So, and the panel continues on. Then she said, appellee stated, no, there's an avenue to dispute this, what my status is. I've sent them letters. It's not in a record. And based upon me being here, you don't think I would have sent them a letter or tried to inquire? They don't respond to me at all. Then you asked about judicial discipline. Okay, by state law, I can't tell you who I filed a judicial complaint against, but none has ever been granted. Not one judicial complaint I've ever filed has ever been granted.
That you filed, I was going to say.
I filed against the judge.
Because surely some judges have been removed in Nebraska. Been some municipal judges that were subject in our court. Go ahead.
They were extraordinary circumstances, yeah. Your Honor. On this type of case, they're not going to discipline, and they're probably not going to do anything on this. So don't believe that I haven't. I've probably filed more judicial complaints than any attorney in the state. So also I wanted to issue about that competent. In terms of competent, what you in Nebraska, as I stated before, you have to have a particular law license. That's it, and you can handle a murder case. There's no specialty. But to get to Judge Shepard's case or issue about injunctive relief, I was dismissed at the 12B6 motion. If this is reversed, this injury is still ongoing. And I stated in my complaint, on page 16, I asked for declaratory and injunctive relief, but I was dismissed out based upon the case law. Now, we get to the Birch case where I have to convince you that Birch does not apply to my particular case. And based upon the facts of Birch, there's the case or the controversy, which is what we're trying to discern. And as I stated before, the facts of the Birch case do not apply to the facts of my case. I'm talking for constitutional violations based upon race. And it's in the best interest, as they do for juveniles, and it's good for the court to make sure that the bar is a multicultural, multi-ethnic bar. And when you exclude blacks from that particular murder cases, you're not treating everybody freely and equally. And my question to the court has constantly been, well, if you're treating the black attorneys with this much disrespect and you're not putting us where we're supposed to do? What are you judges doing in the sentencing of black defendants? So you want to make sure that your particular case and the appointments reflect the community in the bar. The Birch case does not apply. Also, I forgot about the Stump case. The Stump case was a court-ordered sterilization, which was a case or a controversy. So based upon my 10 seconds, I'd ask for you to reverse 12B6, okay, in this case. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Ashford. Okay. Thank you both for your arguments. Case 16-3366, Ashford v. Doe's, is submitted for decision.